Accession number 27243, Mr. Don Reynolds, Reel 12. Now, how were you treated during your... It sounds like you were treated well, but what do you remember of your stay in Durban?
Well, it really is a marvellous place. And the people there were most welcoming. As soon as we landed, got the ship into the dry dock, and the dockyard mateys started taking over, there were just the odd watch was left on board to see that everything was properly maintained and the rest of it. And most of the rest of us were shipped to the suburbs, not very far from Durban, but out to the HMS Assegai, which was the shore barracks. And that was a marvellous place to the likes of us that had not been in barracks for a long time. Proper canteen. Everybody was fed in the huge canteen area there. And each ship, or each watch of each ship, used to have to take part in the helping the distribution of the dinner and the washing up and everything else. It was all part of a system, and it worked extremely well, and I found it most enjoyable.
Now, what about the hospitality of the South African civilians? How did that show itself?
It showed itself absolutely. We were invited to go to I think it must have been a Victoria League club, and there they ran everything as you might expect in a London similar establishment. You were welcomed there, you were fed there, and showers and everything else that you could require, and then they fitted you up with a bed at night as well. And the bed, when I was there anyway, was in one of the old prisons. I always think back to that when I see Ronnie Barker and so on doing his porridge, because I was on the, I think, about the second floor of the block, and you march up there clanging on the stair, and the cell there with its twin bunks and the rest of it. And yes, quite the thing to be, but it was a bed, and that was what mattered. But they did their best to look after us, and I was very, very lucky. I was one of those who was sent on a visit about a week, I think, at a guest farm up in the country. And there were about six or seven of us sent to this particular place. It was the farm of an Irish, an ex-Irish family. And it was at, or near, about 3 or 4 miles from Van Rhenen, which is a very, very small village, right on the boundary of the Orange Free State. And we went up there on the train from Durban through Pietermaritzburg and so on. And the countryside was beautiful, winding through the valley and the rest of it, rather like a travelogue, and dining on in the hotel, in the dining car and the rest of it. It was quite an experience. And when we got to Van Rhenen, the host had come down to greet us, and he took us along across the veld to the farm in the dark, and we could see the ranging out on either side, the flattish country. And when we got to the farm, we were designated to our little outhouses on the outskirts of the farm and its rear area. And there were probably about four of us, I think, in this one little room with its bunks. Just outside was a further one, which was the wash house, and so on. And that was done, was officiated over by Charlie, who was the Bantu servant, and a great guy he was. He was the major domo of the place. He looked after everything, including the at meal times. He was the one who did the distribution. And when there'd be about perhaps 12 or so of us all together there at meal times, the family and the guests, and Charlie would be the one who brought the stuff from the kitchen. And a very interesting man. He'd been with the South African forces in Egypt, or that area, when they were supplying the forces through Eritrea and so on. And he was obviously very, very proud of his army connections. And when we first saw him, he was in his army boots. And he came into the meal establishment, the dining room, in his boots the first occasion. But when he nearly slipped, and he decided to take his boots off before he came with any more. And when he came, he got more items, more plates on his arm than I've seen in any catering establishment anywhere. If he'd have had his boots on that time when he came in, he'd have had at least six platters of whatever it was on the floor. But he was in charge of the shower room as well. And you'd say, if you wanted a shower, you'd say, what time's best for you today, Charlie? And he'd say, oh, 5:30. And he'd see that at 5:30, he'd filled up the oil drum with water. He'd have stoked up his fire nicely until it was piping hot. And then he'd pump this water up into a tank, and it would come down through the shower sprinkler and the rest of it. And he got it absolutely to an art, the right temperature and everything else. If there was anything to do in the area, then call for Charlie.
So you had a good holiday. There was a leave, local leave, really, wasn't it?
Absolutely marvellous. And they, on this, it was a guest farm after all, they got two tennis courts. I think one was grass and one was hard court. And they got a bowling green. And if you couldn't do one thing, you could do another. And in the field at the back, they got, I think, four horses, ponies or something of the type. And you were allowed to use those as well. Not being terribly horsey previously, I did have a go. And it was best, if you could, to get your horse ride in the morning down to Van Rhenen, because if the horse had been to Van Rhenen in the morning, it really didn't want to go out again in the afternoon to do the whatever it was, 3 miles each way or whatever. But it just added to the holiday. And they gave us an excellent time. There were two or three people there, South Africans, who were on holiday, and one or two of them were sort of friends of the family as well. And they looked after us extremely well. played tennis with us and all the rest. And the people of Van Rhenen, it was a very small place, but they welcomed us absolutely, and they put on a party and dance for us. Now, being having two left feet, I didn't get involved in the dance and the rest of it, but the party was a thoroughly good job. And they took us absolutely to their hearts and looked after us extremely well.
Now, what happened when, when the refit was over?
When the refit was... Well, the refit was coming to an end when the first bomb dropped. And that was about the 6th of August, Hiroshima. And it was quite obvious when the other one, the second one, dropped on the 8th, that it was all over. They very quickly came to heel then. And
how did you feel about the use of the atomic bomb and VJ Day?
I think...
Did you know what it was?
Oh, well, I think we very quickly appreciated what it was. Yes, we were pleased. We were pleased because we knew that we were going to be, when we got back in just that very few days, we knew that we were going to be in the front line of the attack or the running fight down the Malay, the Malay Peninsula. I think it was said in the write-up after the war was over that we were the most modern flotilla that was in the East Indies fleet, and they were going to use us as that. So that we'd got pictures. I mean, they may have given up Rangoon, but they weren't going to give up everything else, including Singapore, without a bit of a fight. So the fact that they might go softly, it was quite a thing.
So what happened next then? I mean, if you could guide us through that.
Well, I think it was a matter really of tying up the ends of the refit and getting us turned out and back on duty. And I'm not too clear as to when we actually got back to Trinco, but certainly we were in Singapore in early October. And
what were you doing there?
Well, we were there to help on the tidying up. And Singapore, I think, didn't itself capitulate and be taken over for quite a while. Our people didn't take charge of Singapore immediately. And when we got there, everything ashore was supposedly okay. We did have a run ashore fairly quickly on arrival there. And I think I only went ashore about twice before we sailed out. But I did have time to have a quick glance at what was there. I walked across the front of Raffles Hotel, for instance, and therefore I sort of thought, well, if I've seen Raffles, I've seen, I can say I've seen Singapore. But it's one of those points where it's representative of a place, and I was very pleased to have walked across the grass in front of it. But we didn't see a lot. But Singapore was already a thriving place. The cinemas were open. The lights were up in the streets. I won't call them restaurants, but food places, bars and everything else were in full swing. And you could get almost anything in Singapore so quickly. After the collapse, it was just unbelievable to most of us.
So what happened next?
Well, we were on standby to take or to escort boats of prisoners back to Australia. And a lot of us were rubbing our hands. It was so nice to think of getting to real civilization. That just reminds me that civilization in these terms, I didn't say that at the Fleet Canteen in South Africa, we were absolutely thrilled to bits to be able to get tins of apricots. Now, tins of apricots, I think, for all servicemen almost anywhere in the world, were the return of civilization. If you got that, you felt you were, you know, well catered for. If it was available, okay. And we saw Australia coming with possibility perhaps of Sydney and the rest of it. But before we could do that, they decided that there were still things to be done in Sumatra. And it was a matter of relieving internment camps on Sumatra, and it surprised us, I think, that when Singapore had capitulated and so on, that Sumatra was still under the hands of the Japs. And we were taken off the Australia detail and told, no, get a little bit of parade ground practice in, because you're going to relieve Madame, the prisoner of war camp at Madame, which is one of the principal ports of Sumatra. And on the way to Madame, we went into the river of Port Swettenham. Name rings a bell. We didn't actually get to see the port itself, but we were in there and so on, past an hour or two, and then we came out and picked up with a convoy that had come down from India, a couple of troop ships and a hospital ship. And we were to take these into Madame ourselves and another destroyer. I'm not sure if this would be the Venus or not. But anyway, we set off. And when we were quite a distance out, we stood off and waited for this boat to come out to lead us into the port. And along came this little fishing type smack, a small fishing smack type thing, with three or four obviously Japanese chaps in charge, and they were the first Japanese we'd seen actually on boats and so on, and they weren't the usual slink-eyed types. They were the more the, well, Asian, but tall Asian type, and they looked quite reasonable types. We fell in behind them and were going along towards the port. We were, by this time, we were doled out in our whites. Number one uniform, we'd each got a rifle and everything else, and ready in an hour's time to be on the parade ground, accepting the flag of surrender and the rest of it. When for some silly reason, now I say this from a Matlow's angle, not knowing what is known on the bridge, what the skipper knows or anything else, and it seemed to me that the skipper put on his ASDICs to see that he was having the right depth of water and all the rest of it. And he found that we're on the edge of a minefield. And all hell let loose. And the anchor was dropped quickly and so on. Everybody was falling in step behind us, the boats behind us, the couple of the Indian Army one and the Red Cross one, they came to a halt, and we obviously asked the Japanese what on earth he was doing, leading us into a minefield. Well, what happened, heaven alone knows. But we had to swing on that anchor for, I don't know, up to 24 hours. And everybody else was there as well. And they had to send for BIMPs, as they called them, the small gauzed, weren't they? Anti-magnetic minesweepers, BIMPs, I think we called them. Two or three of those came down to sweep a passage. And they found various mines there. But by the time they had got the minefield cleared so that the ships could go in, they decided that we'd had enough and cleared us off. We never got to shore. But it was quite a scary business when they found that we were in a danger area, and they got everybody possible up onto the top deck in case a mine was actually close at hand, because they might well have been acoustic or anything else. And as soon as it was practical...
And this is in October as well, I presume?
Yes, this would be in October, middle of October, I think, 15th or somewhere there.
So what happened next?
I think, I don't remember after that, whether we tailed it back to Trincomalee, given it up or what. Because the next that I remember is that the war being over, no sweeps were required, obviously. Nobody else needed to be relieved or anything else, as far as our flotilla was concerned. And we were... Obviously, I think the whole flotilla was standing by to return to Blighty. And before we did so, they gave us a little run to show the flag. They're never averse to showing the flag. They sent us on a one-day trip to Cochin in southwest India, and then after that to Madras on the western coast. Now I've got it wrong way round. I think Cochin is on the west and Madras on the east, but anyway, in Cochin we didn't manage to get ashore, or I didn't yet manage to get ashore, but in Madras I did, and that was a marvellous city, not having had any problems with the Japs and so on. It was pure India, and the markets and the rest of it were absolutely marvellous eastern markets. You could walk along there and watch the goldsmiths at work tapping out trays and all sorts of things. The silkware and all the rest of it you'd expect in markets were simply fantastic for the likes of us. And I saw took a short trip on the train just a little way out of the city, and saw everybody hanging on from the sides and on the top and the rest of it, as you see in the films showing the eastern railways. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. There wasn't a lot we could do. We hadn't got facilities for buying very much. So apart from that, I thoroughly enjoyed it, and it only lasted the odd day at each place anyway.
And these were just at Indian ports?
Just Indian, yes. I did go ashore at Penang, again, only on the jetty. I didn't get very far.
That's going backwards.
That's going backwards, yes, just thinking back. But it did remind me that in Penang, that was an eye-opener. On the wooden jetty in Penang, there were two virtually motor speedboats, and they had got all the front packed with gelignite or explosives anyway. And had we gone closer to Penang when sinking the cruiser, or at any other time, these speedboats would have left the harbour and obviously launched themselves kamikaze style into whatever vessel they could find. Now that was an interesting insight into the Japanese mind as well.
So what happened next then?
Well, after that, it was back to Trinco, and preparations for home. And we set off mid-November. And there was a lot of discussion at this time about who goes home. Everybody's conversation was, what group are you? Because when we went in, we were given group numbers in the Army as well as the Navy, I think. And on a lot of things, that was what had the major say. I was actually group 54. And when we left Trinco, we had people come on board who were perhaps group 48 or 50, and they were due to be out weeks before us, obviously, and therefore they were going home. And so it did become a matter of who was left on and who was sent off, and people who were later groups than 54 were sent off, left in Trinco to be attached to one of the other vessels according to how things were running. So from Trinco we went round.
But you did get on it. You were on the ship.
I was on board, and those of us that were in group 54 had got our bags packed, our hammocks lashed and everything ready. Now when we got round to Colombo, it was the same procedure. I'm not sure, we didn't go alongside. I'm sure we were out in the stream, and this boat comes along, and it had got so many people on it that were going to be sent home, and if there were half a dozen of them, they'd got a list, and it was a matter of which half dozen were going to be swapped, and my name was still left on. I was still on Virago with my kit, and others had been drafted off. The same happened at Aden. We went into Aden, and now Aden was a place that we hadn't been to, and that was a remarkable place as far as I was concerned. The heat there was simply fantastic. That was the worst that I had seen for heat. And we saw the people coaling ship. The coal barges came along, and there were people on the barges, and they'd got like steps up the side of the ship that was being coaled, and they'd swing these at least 100 weight bags of coal up the side of the ship, two fellas, up the steps, four or five steps, until they got onto the deck level, and then they'd be tipped onto the, or taken and tipped into the coal hole of the coal burning ship.